Hey, Contra Podcast Conversations, for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Contra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
You know, if you've ever felt a bit overwhelmed by this constant pressure to be happy, then today's deep dive is definitely for you.
Mm-hmm.
We're tackling one of those huge, really slippery human goals, and our guide is Dr. Tim Lamis's fantastic book, Happiness, from the MIT Press Essential Knowledge series.
It's such an important conversation to have right now because, you know, globally, we've sort of boiled happiness down to this this single, often commercialized idea, like it's just a checklist.
Yeah, a static state of always feeling good.
Exactly. And Lomas argues really powerfully, I think, that we need to pull apart that simple idea, replace it with something much richer, more globally informed, a vision of what it means to really flourish as a human.
It's such a paradox, isn't it? We're obsessed with happiness. Self-help aisles are overflowing.
Society constantly tells us to optimize our joy. And yet, anxiety, depression rates, they're still stubbornly high.
Yeah, worryingly high.
It feels like the harder we chase that feeling of happiness, the more it just, you know, slips away.
That's precisely Lomas's point. He suggests the problem isn't us necessarily, it's our map, our conceptual map of well-being.
How so?
Well, if that map is too narrow, if it only defines success as feeling good and avoiding pain, then we're always going to feel like you're failing when life inevitably throws us curveballs.
Yeah.
You know, the full messy reality of being human.
So we need a better map, one that actually includes the bumps in the road.
Exactly. One that embraces complexity, nuance, even difficulty.
Okay, so who's the expert map maker here? Tell us about Dr. Tim Lomas.
Well, he's a senior lecturer in positive psychology at the University of East London, so he has that solid scientific grounding.
Right, academic chops.
Definitely. But what makes him really unique, his standout contribution, is this thing called the Positive Lexicography Project.
Positive lexicography. Okay, what's that? It's this amazing, huge effort he started to catalog untranslatable words, words about well-being specifically from cultures all over the world.
Untranslatable words for well-being, like words we don't have in English.
Exactly. He's identified thousands of them. It's basically like building a global dictionary of positive emotions and states.
Well, that's fascinating.
It really is, because he operates right at this intersection of psychology, linguistics, and cross-cultural studies. And he's very consciously trying to correct the sort of Anglo-centric bias we see in a lot of happiness research.
Which is huge.
It is. His core insight is that language profoundly shapes how we experience well-being. If we don't have a word for a specific emotional nuance, well, we're less likely to even recognize it, let alone cultivate it.
Okay, that makes sense. So let's unpack the book's main argument then. Lomas says our modern idea of happiness is too simple, just static pleasure.
Right, flack.
And he argues true well-being is more like a dynamic tapestry, woven from different threads.
That's a great way to put it. Threads of joy, sure, but also meaning, connection, personal growth, and crucially, even learning how to deal with adversity. It's all part of the weave.
So where does he start building this richer picture?
He takes us back to the ancient Greeks, actually, to this key philosophical distinction that's kind of shaped debates about happiness for centuries, hedonia versus eudaimonia.
Okay, hedonia. That sounds familiar. That's the one we mostly focus on today, right? Happiness is pleasure, feeling good, avoiding pain, rooted in Epicurus.
Exactly. That's the dominant modern view. But then there's eudaimonia, which comes more from Aristotle.
And that's different how?
Eudaimonia is more about flourishing. It's about living a life of meaning, purpose, virtue, realizing your potential as a human being. It's not just about feeling good moment to moment.
Okay, so living a good life, not just a feel-good life.
Precisely. Lomas argues we absolutely need both a balance of hedonia and eudaimonia. But, and this is key, he says even that distinction isn't enough on its own.
Why not?
Because the problem isn't just the philosophy. It's the very word we use in English. Happiness.
Ah, back to the language point.
Yes. It's such a vague umbrella term. It just lumps together so many different experiences.
Like?
Well, like the quick buzz you get from finding a $20 bill on the street versus that deep, quiet satisfaction after finishing a huge, meaningful project. We call both happiness, but they're wildly different states.
Right. Lomas uses his untranslatable words to show that well-being is actually this vast family of related states, as he puts it. States that English often just glosses over.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting. We get to be, what did you call them? Emotional lexicographers.
Aha, exactly. Let's look at some examples. They really highlight what our own language might be missing. How about the Danish term hygge?
Oh yeah, hygge's become quite popular. Cozy vibes, candles.
It has, but it's often sort of simplified. Lomas points out it's not just about being cozy. It's specifically about convivial intimacy, that warm, contented feeling you get in a specific social setting, like sharing coffee and stories with close friends on a winter night.
Okay, so it's inherently social and about connection.
Yes. Then you have something quite different, like the Japanese term wabi-sabi.
Wabi-sabi. I've heard of that. It's about imperfection.
Finding beauty in imperfection, yes. And in transience, in things not lasting forever. It blends acceptance with a kind of positive appreciation. Very different from chasing perfection or constant pleasure.
Wow, yeah. Very different.
And then if you want proof that well-being isn't just about avoiding the tough stuff, look at the Finnish concept of sisu.
Sisu. What's that?
It means something like extraordinary determination, resilience, grit. But specifically in the face of extreme, long-lasting adversity. It's about inner strength when things are incredibly hard.
So well-being can actually emerge from struggle.
That's a key part of the picture Lomas paints. Sisu shows that how we respond to hardship is fundamental to flourishing, not just trying to avoid hardship altogether.
Okay, so if the definition of happiness is this complex, multi-layered thing shaped by culture and language,
yeah.
How on earth do scientists measure it?
Good question. Lomas takes aim squarely at the most common tool, the self-report survey. You know, the classic, on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy are you right now?
Right. Seems straightforward enough.
But Lomas calls it impoverished, and he has several reasons.
Okay, like what?
Well, first, the obvious one, subjectivity. Your 7 could be my 9, or vice versa. How can we compare scores meaningfully across people?
True.
Second, there's memory bias. When you ask someone to rate their happiness over, say, the last month, they don't average it out. Our brains tend to remember the peaks, the most intense moments, and the very end. It's called the peak end rule.
So it's not an accurate summary of the whole period.
Not at all. And third, there's a significant cultural bias, that 1 to 10 question. It assumes a very Western, individualistic focus on personal feeling.
I hope so.
In more collectivist cultures, Lomas notes, asking about your personal happiness might even seem strange or selfish. Well-being might be understood more in terms of family harmony, community success, or fulfilling your social role.
I see. So the question itself imposes a specific cultural value.
Exactly. Lomas uses a great analogy. Asking someone to rate their happiness 1 to 10 is like asking a music critic to rate a Beethoven symphony with a single number.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's impossible.
Right. It just collapses this incredibly rich, complex, multidimensional experience into one potentially misleading data point.
Okay, so measurement is tricky. What about the causes of happiness or well-being? We often see that pie chart. Something like 50% genetics, 10% circumstances, 40% intentional activities.
Oh, yes, the famous pie chart. Lomas really pushes back against that simplistic division.
Why? Doesn't genetics play a big role?
It does. There's likely a genetic set point or predisposition for mood. But Lomas argues these factors aren't neat, separate slices. They are constantly interacting.
Interacting how?
Your genes might give you a certain baseline, but your environment, your choices, your activities, they profoundly influence how those genes are expressed. Genes aren't destiny, he stresses.
Okay, and what about the 10% for circumstances? Things like money, where you live.
That leads us to the hedonic treadmill. Heard of that?
Vaguely. It's the idea that we get used to things. Like, winning the lottery doesn't make you permanently ecstatic.
Exactly. We adapt surprisingly quickly, both the good things and bad things. That initial joy from a raise or a new car, it fades. Money helps up to a point securing basic needs. But beyond that, its impact on long-term well-being diminishes rapidly.
So what does make a lasting difference circumstance-wise?
The research is really clear on this.
Yeah.
The strongest, most consistent factor isn't income or possessions. It's the quality and depth of our social relationships. Real, authentic connections.
That makes intuitive sense. Okay, so let's shift from causes to maybe the function of emotions. Why did evolution even bother giving us positive feelings? Seems like a luxury.
Not according to Barbara Fredrickson's broaden and build theory, which Lomas discusses.
Broaden and build?
Yeah. The idea is that positive emotions aren't just pleasant side effects. They're actually vital psychological tools.
Tools for what?
Well, think about negative emotions first. Fear, anger, they narrow our focus, right? Help us deal with immediate threats. Run from the tiger, fight the attacker.
Okay.
Positive emotions like joy, curiosity, gratitude, love, they do the opposite. They broaden our mindset. They make us more open, more creative, more willing to explore new things, connect with new people.
Okay, so they open us up. And the build part.
That broadened mindset over time helps us build lasting personal resources.
Mm-hmm.
When you're curious, you build knowledge. When you play, you build physical skills. When you feel love or connection, you build stronger social bonds. These resources help us thrive in the long run.
So positive feelings are actually adaptive. They help mm-hmm. us grow.
Absolutely. And this framework, Lomas argues, is crucial for understanding unhappiness too.
How so?
Because if positive emotions broaden and build, what do negative ones do? They signal problems. Sadness, anxiety, guilt. They aren't failures to be suppressed. They are essential data.
Data.
Yeah, messengers telling us something needs attention. Maybe we need to change course, fix a relationship, learn from a mistake, avoid a real danger. A life completely without negative emotion wouldn't just be unrealistic. It would be dangerously uninformed. We'd be clueless.
That's a really powerful reframing. Not seeing sadness or anxiety as the enemy, but as information.
Exactly. Functional signals.
Okay, so if we try to synthesize all this, what are the core messages, the big takeaways from Lomas?
I think there are three really crucial ones. First, the power of linguistic expansion.
Meaning learning new words for well-being actually helps us.
Yes. Our vocabulary literally shapes our emotional reality. Mm. When you learn a word like, say, ikigai, the Japanese concept for your reason for being, your purpose, you don't just learn a definition. You gain a new lens, a new potential state to recognize and cultivate within yourself. It expands what's possible for your own well-being.
Makes sense. What's the second takeaway?
This one feels really important today, rejecting the tyranny of the positive.
The tyranny of the positive, meaning the pressure to always be happy.
Exactly. Lomas argues that true flourishing, deep well-being, actually requires embracing the dialectical nature of life. The idea that opposites are often intertwined.
Like strength coming from struggle.
Precisely. Meaning resilience, character. These often don't blossom despite hardship, but because of it. Suffering isn't just a bug. It can be the crucible where strength is forged. We need to make space for that reality.
That feels liberating, actually. Permission to not be okay sometimes.
It really is. And the third takeaway is almost a universal wisdom, the paradox of pursuit.
The idea that you can't chase happiness directly.
Yeah, it's like trying to grab smoke, or that shy cat metaphor. The harder you chase it, the faster it darts away.
So how do you find it?
Loma says it has to be pursued indirectly, as a byproduct.
A byproduct of what?
Of engaging in meaningful activities, of nurturing relationships, of living in line with your values. You focus on those inputs, and happiness, or better yet, flourishing, is the emergent result. It arises naturally.
Focus on the process, not the prize.
You got it.
Lomas has some really quotable lines that seem to capture these ideas. You mentioned, he says, to truly understand well-being, we must become emotional lexicographers.
Right. That just hammers home the language point. Yeah. More words give us more emotional granularity, more self-understanding, more tools to cultivate well-being.
And this one really resonates. Happiness is not a singular destination to be arrived at, but a dynamic and fluctuating process. It is the emergent property of a life lived with meaning, connection, and acceptance.
Yeah, that completely shifts the goalposts, doesn't it? Stop obsessing about hitting a 10 on some scale. Focus instead on building meaning, strengthening connections, accepting the ups and downs. The feeling will take care of itself in its own time.
And finally, embracing the tough stuff. A truly positive psychology is not one that ignores the negative, but one that understands its indispensable role.
Mm-hmm. Negative emotions aren't failures. They're vital signals. Functional messengers providing crucial information about our lives and what matters to us. We need to learn to listen to them, not just silence them.
So how can people apply these ideas? Let's make it practical. You mentioned reframing negative emotions.
Yeah, that's a big one. So when you feel anxious or guilty or sad, instead of immediately trying to push it away or beating yourself up, pause. Ask yourself, okay, what information might this feeling be trying to give me? What is it signaling about my needs, my values, my situation?
So treat it like data, not an attack.
Exactly. It turns it from an enemy into a potential source of self-awareness and guidance for change.
What's another practical insight?
Practice the indirect path. Consciously shift your focus. Stop asking what will make me happy, because that question often leads you down superficial paths.
Right.
Instead, ask questions like, How can I strengthen my connection with someone important today? Or what's one small action I can take that aligns with my sense of purpose or values? Or even just, what activity can I get lost in?
Focus on the building blocks, the meaningful actions.
Yes. And Lomas also has insights for, say, organizations. Instead of just relying on those simplistic employee satisfaction surveys.
The 1 to 10 scale again.
Right. Organizations should think about how to actively foster eudaimonic well-being, create environments where people feel they have autonomy, opportunities for mastery or skill development, and a sense of purpose in their work. That allows deeper, more sustainable well-being to grow organically.
Build the right conditions and flourishing follows.
That's the idea.
Thinking about the whole book, what was the most surprising thing for you, or what did you love most?
For me, it's genuinely the power of language. The idea that learning a new word like sisu or wabi-sabi isn't just trivia, it literally expands your potential emotional landscape. It gives you new ways to understand and experience your own life. That feels incredibly empowering. Your capacity for well-being isn't fixed. It can grow with your vocabulary.
That is really cool. For me, I think the biggest thing was the sense of relief. The permission slip, almost.
Permission for what?
Permission to not feel happy all the time. The book is such a powerful antidote to that relentless cultural pressure for constant positivity and bliss. It validates the full spectrum of human experience and shows how meaning and strength often lie precisely in navigating the difficulties. It lets you be human.
Beautifully put. It makes space for the whole picture.
So maybe a final thought for you listening, building on that idea of language.
Yeah, maybe challenge yourself. Think about your own current state of well-being right now. Is there an untranslatable word, maybe one we mentioned, or maybe one from your own cultural background, or even just a specific feeling you haven't named before that captures its complexity?
Don't just settle for fine, or happy, or stressed.
Right. Try to find a more nuanced word. Give that feeling the specific name it deserves. Acknowledge its texture, its complexity. It's a small step towards becoming your own emotional lexicographer.
A great place to start. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the language, science, and, well, the sheer complexity of flourishing.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akhotra Foundation.